United States and around the world are extremely alarmed.
James Green, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of Brazilian history and culture at Brown University, and Bruno Tortuja, journalist and photographer in Sao Paulo. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Check all our coverage of Brazil at democracynow.org.
And you were listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 2nd, from noon to 10 p.m. at St. Andrew's Church in Portland. This is the 10-year anniversary of the celebration of Dia de los Muertos in Portland. There will be altar building, Muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, storytelling for children, traditional Mexican food, drink, and live musical performances. Benefiting No Olvidados, a border group that is providing water out in the desert for immigrants. Again, that's the Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 2nd from noon to 10 p.m. at St. Andrew's Church, 806 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member support and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years, serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery in Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar at North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopworksbeer.com. It is a couple minutes past five, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, family and supporters of a man killed by Portland police last month demonstrated downtown this morning after a grand jury declined to indict the responsible officers.
The president made the claim today that the 14th Amendment does not grant citizenship to everyone born in the United States.
And in international news, we'll take a look at the ongoing possibility that the Palestinian leadership will no longer recognize the existence of Israel.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 31st, 2018. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Carly Meisberger. Portland police officers Gary Britt and Jeffrey Livingston shot and killed 27-year-old Patrick Kimmins last September. Earlier today, a Multnomah County grand jury found the killing justified. KBOO's Joe Meyer was at the courthouse and filed this report.
According to Portland Cop Watch, the police shooting death of Patrick Kimmins is one of four administered by Mayor Wheeler's police bureau so far this year. Last year, there were six. This morning, a grand jury exonerated the officers involved. I spoke with protesters in downtown Portland outside of the courthouse at 4th and Main.
Justice for Patrick Kimmins and that they release the video of his shooting to the public.
Can I say why you're out here today?
It's demand justice for Patrick Kimmins and an end to white supremacist state violence.
Can you say why you're out here today?
I'm here to support the family of Patrick Kimmins and to protest the white supremacist justice system of the United States.
I'm out here today to serve justice for my brother Patrick Kimmins. I didn't get to see the video, but my family got to see the video. I'm just out here because if it had been one of y'all family members, y'all would understand and y'all would be doing the exact same thing. He had kids. He mattered to every one of us, and y'all don't understand that until it happens to you. That's all I have to say.
Yep.
They don't want to show the public this video because they know they're wrong, but they let us watch it.
You watch it?
Yeah, we watch it, but they don't want to show it to the public.
You want to tell it? You want to tell my listeners what you saw on that video?
Yeah, what's on the video is my brother has his hands up. But if you're a police officer, how they said my brother was armed and ran at him with a gun, if you're a police officer, if I'm running at you with a gun, you're going to automatically take fire at me. You see what I'm saying? My brother came at him, running towards him. They say freeze. My brother splits between two cars. And then they fire at him. Boom, when it's back time. Boom, 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 boom. And he's taking him. Don't get me wrong, he's taking him. He takes about six shots. And then he falls. He starts to tumble. And as he's falling to the ground, they still fire. Boom, 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 boom. Still fire. So, you know what I'm saying? It's wrong. It's wrong. They wrong. They know they wrong. And they can't. I don't see how you're going to justify that. That's not justifiable. So, like I said, they need to release that video to the public and let the public see, too.
Yeah.
That's not right. Why won't you release it to the public? If you justified it and it's that easy to justify, you should let the public see it.
Video to be released. His hands was up. He didn't have a gun in his hand. I watched the video. My son, Patrick Kim's hands was up. It was up.
And they still shot.
And then when he was on the ground, he was laying like this, and the police was over him shooting him in his back with a .45.
Who are you?
Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Yeah, they're dirty. These people are dirty.
Would you like to talk to me?
Yeah, here. I'm down here today for a protest. I got called yesterday to come in here and watch the video. They demanded me to watch the video and gave me a deadline because they want to release it. I watched the video, and to all you guys, my son's hands was up like this between two cars. After they shot him as he was turning into the cars, he fell fat, placed it on his face, like this, still with his hands up. The officer got over him like this and started shooting my son in the back, and then flipped his body over. They are murderers. They murderers. They shot my baby 12 times, multiple times in his back while he was laying on the ground.
Why do you think they shot your son?
The guy came out, whatever the story was, when I watched the video, I seen a fight. Patrick was struck. Another guy was struck. Next thing you know, I see officers coming through the parking lot. You see them just shooting, but they didn't shoot my son until my son turned his back. Now, if he was a threat, why did they shoot him when they was frontwards? They waited till he turned like this and went like this. And then that's when they shot him. What they said was, we shot them because we seen a red muzzle. We seen a red flash. We shot them because we seen a red flash. I asked the DA, I said, do you think that this is justice? Justified? He said, no. But I said, no. I asked, my son asked him, is it a yes or no? He said, no, it's not.
What do you want to happen next?
I want them to release the video. I demand for Portland police to wear body cameras the whole time of an incident. I demand for them to release the video of my son. They don't want to release it now. Why? Because they're wrong. It's not justifiable.
Those were voices of supporters and family of Patrick Kimmons. According to the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, the use of deadly force against Mr. Kimmons by Portland Police Bureau Sergeant Gary Britt and Officer Jeffrey Livingston was a lawful act of self-defense. And this is Joe Meyer with KBU News.
Today, President Trump said the 14th Amendment does not grant citizenship to everyone born in the United States. The first sentence in the amendment states, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside," end quote. Trump claims the phrase, "under the jurisdiction thereof," excludes some born here from citizenship. 2 days ago, Trump spoke of changing the amendment by executive order, which many declared would be unconstitutional. The 14th Amendment, passed after the Civil War, was created to give protection to former slaves and children of immigrants.
Early voter turnout began at a record pace in several states, indicating that overall turnout will be higher than the usual midterm election. First day voting in Georgia, which has already drawn a lot of attention because Brian Kemp, the attorney general in charge of elections, is also the Republican candidate for governor, was triple that of 2014. While Texas traditionally has one of the lowest turnouts for midterm elections, this year's voting has spiked, in part due to the close Senate race between Beto O'Rourke and incumbent Ted Cruz. In 11 states, including Florida, Montana, and Maryland, there are more early votes already recorded with a week left to Election Day than the total early votes in 2014. According to a poll by the Harvard Kennedy School's Institute of Politics, 40% of voters under 30 said they would definitely vote in the midterms, up from 26% in 2014 and 27% in 2010.
Nancy Abel is a lifesaver. Nancy Abel is of Sultan, Washington, which is a small town west of the Cascades on Route 2. While hiking near Stevens Pass last week, Abel met Katrin Grena, a German trying to complete her trek of the Pacific Coast Trail, which runs from the Mexican border to Canada. Abel, an experienced hiker, tried to convince Grena to stop her hike because of worsening weather and Grena's lack of snow gear. Grena was determined to continue, and Abel went home, but continued to monitor the weather. With snow and cold temperatures in the Cascades this week, Abel called 911. Yesterday, the Snohomish County helicopter rescue team found Grena near Glacier Peak, soaking wet, low on food, her tarp shelter having blown away. Like many parts of the Pacific Crest Trail, the area near Glacier Peak does not have cell service. Rescuers found and followed Grena's footsteps in the snow. Abel offered Grena a place to stay until she returns to Germany.
The bodies of two sisters from Saudi Arabia, bound with tape and facing each other, washed ashore in New York City's Hudson River waterfront. Tala and Ratana Faria, age 16 and 22, lived in Fairfax, Virginia, and had been reported missing in August. The day before the bodies were discovered, the sister's mother told detectives that she had received a call from the Saudi Arabian embassy in Washington, ordering the family to leave the U.S. because her daughters had applied for political asylum. Tala and Ratana were fully clothed, and their bodies showed no obvious signs of trauma. Circumstances and causes of death have not yet been determined. The sisters, who had come to America with their mother in 2015, had left their family home and were placed in a shelter after an earlier disappearance in December 2017.
The Public News Service is a daily news wire in the public interest with bureaus in 36 states, including... Today's roundup of national stories from the Public News Service begins with the President and First Lady arriving in Pittsburgh in the wake of the massacre of 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue on Saturday. They were not exactly welcome.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Wednesday, October the 31st, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Protesters greet the President and First Lady as Pittsburgh buries its dead. Also on the Wednesday rundown, groups slam Trump's plan to revoke birthright citizenship. Plus, we'll tell you about a program that's helping families heal.
Now, our top story, tragedies like the massacre that took place in a Pittsburgh synagogue over the weekend usually move people to put politics aside, but USA Today reports as President Trump touched down Tuesday in a city still reeling from the most deadly anti-Semitic attack in American history, he was greeted by hundreds of protesters singing softly in Hebrew or holding signs, underscoring how controversy tends to follow Trump, even on the most solemn of occasions. USA Today says just days after a gunman burst into the Tree of Life synagogue, killing 11, Trump was once again thrust into the uneasy role of consoling a deeply divided nation, even as he has relied on increasingly sharp rhetoric to define Democrats ahead of the midterms. Latino and civil rights groups are dismissing President Donald Trump's plans to end birthright citizenship, calling it an unconstitutional election week stunt to appeal to his base.
Trump said in an interview Monday that he's planning an executive order revoking the right to automatic citizenship for people born on American soil and will reserve it only for babies with at least one parent who is a citizen. Karina Martinez with the group Mi Familia Vota in Nevada says birthright citizenship was spelled out in the Constitution's 14th Amendment precisely to defend against this type of discrimination.
The proposal is a provocation, but it's more than just that. It's really an attack on the principle of equality in our country.
The 14th Amendment was put in place after the Civil War to protect former slaves and their children and has been open to different interpretations over the years. President Trump said on Monday that it's ridiculous for someone to have citizenship solely because they're born in the U.S., but any such executive order would provoke litigation because the Constitution can only be changed by a two-thirds majority in Congress or passage by two-thirds of state legislatures. I'm Suzanne Potter.
According to the American Immigration Council, nearly one in five Nevada residents is an immigrant, and one in six is a native-born U.S. citizen with at least one immigrant parent. Meantime, Mark Richardson reports political leaders and political officials are calling next week's midterm elections some of the most important votes Americans will cast in several decades.
Massachusetts voters will mark their ballots in races for U.S. Senate and House seats, the governor, state legislators, and other statewide officials, and several ballot initiatives including campaign spending and transgender rights. Jeanette Senecal with the League of Women Voters says it's important to study the candidates and issues before casting those votes.
They should take some time to learn about the candidates and the ballot issues. They can go to vote411.org where they can put in their address and we will give them who's going to be on their ballot and what issues are also going to be on their ballot so they can figure out who would best represent them.
She adds voters should make sure they know their precinct number and the location of their polling place. Massachusetts voters should bring identification with them. A driver's license or state ID card is best, but officials will accept other forms of ID.
In Massachusetts, 68% of registered voters cast ballots in the general election in 2016. That's well above the national average of 60%. The use of oil and gas drilling in New Mexico in the past 18 months has also led to a surge of influence spending in the race for the next commissioner of public lands. Ros Brown explains.
Democrat Stephanie Garcia-Richard, Republican Pat Lyons, and Libertarian Michael Lucero all want the job. But the Chevron Corporation has poured $2 million into the race to support Lyons, primarily for television ads. Liliana Castillo with Conservation Voters New Mexico says the state deserves a commissioner who will hold oil and gas companies accountable and protect New Mexico's air, land, and water.
In New Mexico in particular, we have more acres of state trust land than any other state in the country. So that makes the Commissioner of Public Lands the most powerful land manager in the West.
A Lyons spokesperson said they had no control over who contributes money to his campaign. Castillo notes that the commissioner also has the power to regulate methane emissions in a state where the Four Corners methane cloud is as large as Delaware.
New Mexico's economy relies heavily on the boom and bust revenues from oil and gas production. Castillo says renewable energy, including wind and solar, need to be part of a diversifying of the state's economy for future generations. And finally, Mary Sherman tells us the opioid crisis has left some parents struggling with addiction, resulting in an overburdened foster care system. An innovative program is expanding in the state of Ohio to help these parents and their children heal.
Highland County is one of the first 17 counties participating in the Ohio START pilot. It combines the efforts of children's services, juvenile courts, and behavioral health treatment providers to support parents fighting substance abuse whose children have been removed from the home. And a key element of the program is peer mentors like Ray Jean Noble.
Families can reach out to us with concerns as far as their treatment or case plans or anything like that, and we can act as a go-between the families and the caseworker, but also we can use our experience to kind of help guide them through the process.
The program began in 2017 and is now expanding to 17 more counties, thanks to federal grant money from the Attorney General's Office and the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services.
It is estimated that 80% of the abuse and neglect cases in Ohio's child welfare system are related to drugs, including opioids. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for starting your day newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Outcasting is a production of the organization Media for the Public Good, covering LGBTQ issues from a youth perspective. Outcasting Overtime is a monthly commentary from some of Outcasting's youth producers, and this month's edition focuses on the recent wave of political violence in the U.S.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Lucas, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Dhruv talks about the recent pipe bomb assassination attempts of high-profile liberal leaders and a recent mass shooting in a Pittsburgh synagogue. Both of these attacks indirectly target minority groups and may have been fueled by President Trump's hateful rhetoric over the past few years.
At the end of October, we witnessed one of the worst strings of assassination attempts in recent American history when a Florida man sent pipe bombs to prominent Democrats. A few days later, a man walked into a Pittsburgh synagogue and killed 11 people in one of the worst anti-Semitic acts in recent history. It is not a huge leap in logic to conclude that these attacks were fueled in part by the legitimization of hate coming from the White House. First, the attempted bombings. 14 pipe bombs were sent out to prominent members of the political minority party, including targets such as former President Barack Obama, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Robert De Niro, and George Soros. When the alleged maker of the bombs was apprehended, authorities found a list of over 100 other prominent liberal targets. The people who had received the bombs had all been singled out and attacked by President Trump in tweets and in speeches. Many conservative news sources outlandishly attempted to blame Democrats, saying that Democrats had actually sent the bombs. It was found that the alleged bomber was a devoted Trump supporter, as could be seen by the multitude of stickers adorning the exterior of his van. Then, on Saturday, October 27th, Robert Bowers entered the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh and opened fire on the worshippers gathered there. 11 people were killed. The shooting has already been designated as a hate crime, based on the fact that Bowers spewed violent anti-Semitic messages while committing the horrendous shooting. In addition, it was found that Bowers was a white nationalist who often spewed hate on far-right fringe websites. The White House Press Secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, has repeatedly asserted that the president is not responsible for these acts, and the president has uttered words condemning the attacks. But the president has uttered a much greater number of words over a much longer period of time, fanning the flames of both uncivil rhetoric and division in America. There is absolutely no way that the president does not deserve some of the blame following these horrendous acts. President Trump may not have pulled the trigger in these shootings, he may not have addressed the packages of bombs, but his incendiary rhetoric has enabled people to embrace their hate and express it publicly, be it against liberals, immigrants, Jewish people, or the LGBTQ community. When people who harbor these vile thoughts believe that they will not be denounced for their hateful beliefs and acts, it is almost inevitable that this kind of thing will happen. President Trump's refusal to condemn the people responsible for spreading hate in our country, such as the neo-Nazis in Charlottesville and the various white supremacists that he has endorsed, directly contribute to the normalization of this hate. The office of the president should be a beacon of the American spirit, a symbol of the best of what America can be and what can happen. Instead, this president is fraying the fabric of understanding, openness, and liberty in America, thus endangering the American dream, the futures of minorities, and democracy itself. This hate is dangerous for all minorities and for all Americans, and it needs to end. So in the words of Donald J. Trump himself, please get out and vote.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producer is Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo with Mike Crenshaw. At 6, it's Keeping It Real, followed at 7 by Combined Culture Radio. Tonight's weather is a 90% chance of showers with a low of 55. Tomorrow offers patchy fog, a slight chance of showers, and a high of 64. Today in history, 50 years ago in 1968, President Lyndon Johnson announced the end of U.S. military bombing of North Vietnam, citing the progress of peace talks in Paris. The Vietnam War did not end until April 30th of 1975. The quote of the day is from journalist Dan Rather, who is 87 today. "Courage is being afraid, but going on anyhow."
The treat KBOO news poet Dan Raphael is hoping this is the end of Trump's tricks.
"12 bombs there, 11 shot dead here. The Oregonian runs an editorial humanizing the leader of Patriot Prayer. Trump does his scheduled rallies, lying to justify. Next day, he talks about changing the Constitution by executive order, and it doesn't matter if he's ignorant and or lying, because it gets our attention. Trump says he's a nationalist, as Hitler was a nationalist, as in white nationalist. As Maya Angelou said, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. There's no treat here, it's all trick, lies and diversions. What's more haunted than the slave-built White House with a president who can't be a zombie because he's allergic to brains? More likely he's some archetypal demon feeding on suffering and death. The night of all souls is followed by the day of the saints. Be a saint. At least be human. Help someone. Keep speaking out. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael."
And now, it's Black History 365 from our friends at KPFT Houston.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is October 31st. On this day in 1960, Earl Francis Lloyd played for the Washington Capitals against the Rochester Royals, becoming the first African American to play in the NBA. Nicknamed the Big Cat, Lloyd played 9 seasons of professional basketball. For a brief period of time, Lloyd served in the Korean War. He then played 6 seasons for Syracuse and another 3 seasons for the Detroit Pistons before retiring in 1961.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
Last week, KBOO aired audio of Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek speaking at a basic rights Oregon rally in opposition to a federal proposal to change the federal definitions of gender. If the memo were to go into effect, it would effectively erase federal recognition of the reality of trans and non-binary people. In her remarks, Kotek described the proposal as, quote, "nothing more than fear-mongering. It is anti-science, and it is political games in the worst case," unquote, adding that Oregon will continue to lead on transgender rights despite the federal government ignoring legal precedent. Kotek is running for re-election in Oregon House District 44, which covers the upper parts of North Portland and inner Northeast. We also reached out to Kotek's only opponent in the race, Libertarian candidate Manny Guerra, who spoke to KBOO on Monday to give his take on the trans memo.
Well, for me, I think it actually hits really close to home. It's very personal. Just because as my current employment, I work for a college, and I'm on the Title IX team as an investigator. So I know these kind of things will adversely affect our students. It's also a slippery slope. This is not based on any kind of science, and science will tell you otherwise that there's a large spectrum when it comes to gender. There's even times when people are born where they appear to be female but have XY chromosomes as a male. So there's about 1 in 1,500 births that happen that way. So the whole thing is, this is just really dangerous. I think it's you're already marginalizing a portion of our society that's already facing severe discrimination, and this needs to stop, and we need to stand up and say something. It's not okay for us to continue to allow this administration specifically to target certain people, especially when they're always being targeted, you know, unjustly, unfairly, especially with a city just like Portland, where we say we're very progressive. We all must stand up and say something and fight back against this. This is not based on any kind of science. All it does is just limit and squashes people from feeling comfortable and just coming to us when they need help. And that's what I don't want. And I could see that happening with in the situation that I'm at the college I work for. Usually what Title IX is, it was set up so there wasn't any unfair gender bias. It started with sports, but now it actually grew into sexual assault and other forms of, you know, like you can't have a class that's all one gender. So we investigate discriminatory behavior against a student or a faculty member. So this right here will just limit somebody from having a voice. And that's what's really dangerous. We should give voice to the people that need it. And we shouldn't be doing something that is in the contrary to that. And that's what I've been seeing with this administration. They're just constantly just trying to cut people out and you know, only give voice to basically the powerful. And that's not right. And I stand totally against this. And I think we all should stand against this. So I think an open conversation, I think all young people to get out there and vote, that's the number one thing. Multnomah County just had a stat to show that 2 years ago, only 12% voted between 18 and 25. That's a really low number, and we need to change that. And let's get out there, let's just vote. Your vote counts, so just get out there.
That was Manny Guerra running against Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek for District 44. Kotek's comments on the trans memo can be found in the podcast of the KBOO Evening News for October 23rd at kboo.fm/eveningnews.
Thanks to doctors in Switzerland, three paralyzed men that were told they will never be able to walk again can now walk. An electrical device inserted around the men's spines boosted signals from their brains to their legs and helped damaged nerves in the spinal cord to regrow. The first patient to be treated was a 30-year-old Swiss man, David Emze, who suffered a severe injury in a sporting accident. David was told he would never be able to walk again, but can now walk up to a kilometer at a time. When the transmitter is turned on, it helps him walk dramatically better than when it's turned off. Your brain sends electrical signals to your legs along the spinal cord. When the cord is damaged, you can become paralyzed. The implant simply boosts signals to the brain that were once weakened by spinal damage. The BBC reported that Mr. Mze's implant was surgically inserted by one of Switzerland's leading neurosurgeons, Dr. Jocelyn Bloch, from Lausanne University Hospital. She said she was astonished at his improvement. David can now walk up to 8 paces with his implant turned off, and this is the first time that this has been recorded in a chronic spinal injury.
Out of the science lab, it is hard for David to walk more than a few paces. The signals from the implant soon become uncomfortable, so it can't be used all the time. The BBC reports that the system is also expensive and not reliable enough to be used outside of the laboratory for day-to-day use, so it's far from a cure. According to Dr. Mark Bacon, executive and scientific director of the charity Spinal Research, it does show that paralysis can be reversed to a certain degree. He says it is doubtful the implant in its current form can be plausible treatment for all patients. But he does say, quote, It demonstrates we have a workable model of what is required to stimulate regeneration and that, ultimately, paralysis is surmountable, unquote. David Emsey is the first of three patients who have benefited from the first wave of treatment. Two other men have also managed to walk again, to varying degrees.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One. Today's segment begins with the story of a Yakima tribal chairman denied entry to the U.S. Supreme Court because of his headdress.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments Tuesday in a case that questions the rights outlined in an 1855 treaty between the United States and the Yakima Nation in Washington. Tribal Chairman Jode Gowdy says his tribe agreed to give up a swath of land larger than the state of Maryland when they signed the treaty.
We gave up the vastness of that land base for these reserved rights and the ability to, in this case, conduct trade and our commerce.
In exchange for the land, tribal members could travel freely on public highways. The treaty clause is unique to the Yakima Nation, and attorneys for the tribe say it also applies to goods brought to market on public highways. In 2013, Washington's Department of Licensing demanded $3.6 million from the owner of the Cougar Den, a gas station on the reservation. The main question now is whether tribal members should be taxed by the state if the gas is sold on the reservation. Supreme Court justices are expected to meet in private later this week to discuss the case. Meanwhile, the Yakima chairman was denied entry into the U.S. Supreme Court. Emily Schwing has more on the incident.
Jode Gowdy dons his traditional regalia with purpose for important occasions, and a visit to the highest court in the U.S. is no exception. After all, he's the chairman of the sovereign Yakima Nation. But diplomacy didn't seem to sway a security guard outside the Supreme Court.
So the court is not to be subject to outside influence. The headdress itself will not be allowed inside the courtroom.
Gowdy posted a video of the interaction on social media. The security guard told Gowdy there were decorum issues in the courtroom, and his headdress could obstruct the view for others. The chairman called the experience dehumanizing.
Well, I wouldn't say it was an outright show of disrespect. I think there's probably some misinterpretation and our misunderstanding with regard to the significance of what our traditional attire and regalia means to us.
Gowdy refused to remove his headdress, so he was forced to wait outside until arguments were over. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
The Hawaii Supreme Court Tuesday approved construction of the 30-meter telescope atop of Mauna Kea. Hawaii News Now reports Native Hawaiian people hold the area sacred and groups have been fighting the project. Plans for the telescope date back to 2009. In recent years, protests have halted construction. A University of Montana professor is honored for her book from a national history organization. Montana Public Radio's Nick Mott reports.
Rosalind Lapeer, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies, received two separate honors, the John C. Ewards and Donald Fixico Book Awards, honoring excellence in historical writing from the Western History Association at a banquet recently.
I think it was great that I won as an Indigenous woman, but I also think that it was important to sort of open those doors for the next generation of Indigenous scholars and Indigenous women to be doing the types of research and writing that I was doing.
Her book, called Invisible Realities, Storytellers, Story Takers in the Supernatural World of the Blackfeet, focuses on the tribe's relationship with the natural world. Lapeer is an enrolled member of the Blackfeet tribe.
I am Blackfeet, and I am from that community, but I think that their story is universal in a lot of ways.
She says as events like the protests surrounding the Dakota Access Pipeline take the national spotlight, her look at the past can inform issues in the present. This award is the first time an Indigenous woman as a standalone author has received such honors from the Western History Association. Lapeer received another award from the organization in 2016 for a book she co-authored. For National Native News, I'm Nick Mott.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You can find more news, stories, and podcasts from Native Voice One at their website, nv1.org. They are also producing a 5-hour-long live election night special, which can be streamed from their website from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. next Tuesday, November 6th. KBOO will also be airing an hour of coverage from NV1 on election night from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. Here, once again, is NV1's Antonia Gonzalez with more information.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News. Imagine what media would look like if stories from the indigenous world led the daily news. There would be stories about people, culture, and yes, politics. That's why three national media organizations have decided to rewire the world. We're going to cover Election Day with Native America at its center. Of course, we'll report the big picture. You'll know who wins and loses, red and blue, and all that. But we'll also tell you what happened to the more than 10 tribal citizens running for Congress, another dozen running for state offices, and more than 100 for state legislatures. FNX, First Nations Experience, Native Voice One, and Indian Country Today are going live coast to coast with election returns like you've never seen before.
Once again, KABU will be airing live coverage from Native Voice One on election night from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., following an hour of coverage from the Pacifica Network from 6 to 7. From 8 to 10 p.m., KABU will have live, locally produced coverage of local and statewide measures and races, with regular national updates. So remember to tune in Tuesday, November 6th, after the KABU Evening News, for 4 hours of up-to-the-minute election coverage like you've never heard it before.
Israeli politicians are condemning a decision by the Palestine Liberation Organization, or PLO, to no longer recognize the State of Israel, according to the Jerusalem Post. The decision came Monday with a vote by the PLO Central Committee in Ramallah, de facto capital of the West Bank, which has been occupied by Israel since the Six-Day War in 1967. If the decision takes effect, it would nullify the Oslo Accords of 1993, which set out a path towards Palestinian statehood. Observers on both sides of the issue have taken issue with the stipulations of the Accords and called into question the value, validity, and legitimacy of the whole process. The proposal to no longer recognize Israel still needs to be approved by a select committee and the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. For more on the potential decision, we go to the KPFK North Hollywood's Middle East Minute Plus with Esty Chandler.
I'm Esty Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. As a result of a meeting convened late on Monday, the Palestine Liberation Organization's Central Council has announced that it is suspending its recognition of the State of Israel. The PLO announcement said it will halt all its commitments to the, quote, occupation authorities, unquote, until Israel recognizes a Palestinian state within the 1967 borders, with East Jerusalem as its capital, which includes security cooperations and trade agreements reached between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. The council also explicitly rebuked the Donald Trump-led peace process and his quote-unquote deal of the century plan to end the conflict. While the Central Council's decisions are not binding, it advises the Palestinian Authority on future policy decisions, and PA President Mahmoud Abbas was present at the meeting. In other news, Syria's foreign ministry has reportedly sent two letters to the United Nations chief and the UN Security Council president protesting against Israel's holding municipal elections for local councils in three villages in the occupied Golan Heights yesterday. The letters are reported to stress that the elections contradict UN resolutions and the Geneva Agreements on territories under occupation, and that Syrian citizens who organized protests to these elections, including elderly and children, were met by Israeli police and soldiers using tear gas and other weapons to disperse the protesters. And as repercussions of the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi continue, the Istanbul Chief Prosecutor's Office said today that Khashoggi was strangled to death soon after he entered the Saudi consulate and that his body parts were disposed of after being dismembered. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, October 31st, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Lucas Campbell, Dan Raphael, and Joe Meyer. Our engineer is David Kesters. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. The incoming news director is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Carly Meisberger.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Sojourner Truth Radio, coverage of the Pittsburgh synagogue attack and the terrorist murders in Louisville. At 9, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Fight the Empire reports on the recent election of ultra-right-wing presidential candidate Bolsonaro in Brazil. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Between the Covers talks to author Stuart Perrin about his memoir, Light in Jerusalem. And at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, interviews and discussions of works by African-American authors. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Carly.
Good night, Sam.
And good night, David.
Now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo on KBOO.FM and 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Mike Crenshaw. This is our weekly segment. Delphine Crescenzo, or me, comes to you on a weekly basis talking about news from in and around the KBOO community. And tonight, I'm here to host a very special guest, Tripp Burnett.